I'm Jason Pack, and this is Disorder, a podcast where we try to find order in our mad, 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 mad world. Dear orderers, if I ask you to picture the global enduring disorder, what springs to mind? Might it be the militia-filled streets of Tripoli, bombed-out Soviet-style apartment buildings of Mariupol, or just Alexandra Hall's kids' bedrooms? Now, if I ask you to picture another concept, please visualize with me global enduring paradise. You might be thinking of some white sand beach, the sun is out, no clouds in the sky, you're lying back in your sand chair, you have a Mai Tai, you know, with those paper umbrellas in it. What are you visualizing when you're thinking of this global enduring paradise? It's something akin to a stereotypical Caribbean island vacation resort. And yet, rather than those Caribbean islands being a counterpoint and a refutation of the existence of the global enduring disorder, they really are a part of and represent the global enduring disorder. It's a region that we don't usually associate with instability, but which has fallen prey to a dose of mayhem with a famous gang uprising in Haiti over the past months. And the region is always a center of tax evasion, money laundering, failed states, offshore gambling licenses, and, you know, all those other vices of unregulated global interconnectedness. To help us delve deeper into these topics, I am very honored to be joined by our returning champion, Arthur Snell. He is the host of the Behind the Lines podcast and former British High Commissioner to Trinidad and Tobago and author of How Britain Broke the World. Welcome, Arthur.
Jason, thank you. It's great to be here.
Arthur, the Caribbean, is it really a disordered mess?
Well, some of the most basic indicators point in that direction. So what we're seeing in Haiti at the moment is a collapsing state, a state that is in free fall, in state failure. Gangs have taken over. The government is basically non-functional. And there are questions of some kind of military intervention, certainly an international intervention. But that's not the first time that's happened in Haiti. And in some ways, Haiti's an outlier. You can't hold up Haiti as a case study for the rest of the region. But even for those countries in the Caribbean region, which are perhaps seen as much more highly functional countries, there are some very disturbing indicators. And one of the most particularly outstanding ones is homicide. So the highest rates of homicide are found in Caribbean countries. And that is, if you like, a proxy for a society in deep distress, I think.
I think that hits the nail on the head, Arthur. When the social fabric is intact, even if there's a civil war going on, there isn't homicides outside of that civil war. I remember being in the Jabal Nafusa, which are the western mountains of Libya, and I saw a guy with a RPG. And we're chatting with him, and then we went back to his house, and like he has a few AK-47s. And he said to me, you know, Jason, if in your busted country with no morality, you had this level of like personal arms, there would be a lot of homicides. But we here in Libya, because we have the social fabric and we have Islam and all of that, we only kill each other in the context of militia and gang violence, not so much in like personal homicides. Mm. And I think there is something to that, no?
Yeah, I think that's right. So the country I know best in the Caribbean is Trinidad and Tobago. I served there as a British High Commissioner, as you mentioned. For those not familiar with that arcane title, I was the equivalent of an ambassador. So Trinidad and Tobago, I think, is currently third or fourth globally for homicides as a proportion of the population. So that means that in absolute numbers, more people are murdered every year in that country with its really rather small population than they are in Britain with a population of 50 times bigger.
Pretty astounding.
Yeah, which is a really horrifying thought. And of course, in a small country, arguably the impact of so many homicides is greater. More people know one another. You have more extended families represented within the population and so on. So the social cost of this is substantial. Now, some of this is about gang violence and maybe the term gang and militia, there are some overlaps there. But a lot of this is about a society in which, for example, basic functions of law enforcement have broken down. The courts find themselves unable to convict the perpetrators of homicide. So homicide is basically a consequence-free crime. And then you add to that some of the factors that are peculiar to that part of the world. So the Caribbean obviously sits geographically between South America and North America. It sits in a zone of transshipment of illegal narcotics, famously cocaine coming out of the Andean countries, but also more recently synthetic opioids and other things. The transshipment of those creates a whole culture of criminality, of gang violence and so on. And then you add to that much deeper social questions around the social fabric of these countries. Many of these countries' populations are based on populations whose ancestors had been shipped there as part of the transatlantic slave trade. It's not surprising that that brings with it all kinds of challenges, both sort of socially and in the kind of wider context of sort of family structures.
Despite being from America, I've never been to the Caribbean, Arthur. Is the role of traditional religion and traditional social structures much weaker than in corresponding areas in the old world, so that you don't have the community policing things as much as you might do in, say, Africa or the Middle East?
It's a hard question to answer. I think where you see a very positive outlook of it, and it, you know, it's worth talking about that as much as we can talk about some of the challenges. So to take Trinidad and Tobago, for example, it's an extraordinarily diverse society. There are people of African heritage whose ancestors would mostly have been trafficked as part of the transatlantic slave trade. There are people of what in that country is called East Indian, by which other people might think of as South Asian heritage, whose ancestors would have come normally as part of an indentured workforce. So their terms were not quite the same as slavery, but not a huge amount better, probably.
And that was mostly in the late 19th century?
Yes. And effectively, it was what the British Empire was doing once the slave trade had been outlawed. So by no means a situation that respected those people's rights, but was clearly one step up from sort of full slavery. And then you have a smaller pockets of other communities, people of white European heritage, people of Chinese heritage, people of Portuguese heritage, but a lot of those are actually from the island of Madeira. So it's a sort of particular subset. And what you find in Trinidad is a truly multicultural society. And where that has, I think, a lot of upsides is, for example, it's a society that attaches a lot of value to religion, but not in an exclusive way. So you might have public holidays that represent Eid, Diwali, Catholic Christian holidays, African heritage holidays as well. So that on one level shows a truly multicultural society. And I think you also see it in the cuisine of that country. On the other hand, I think to answer your question, I think there may be something about communities that in some way are deracinated, you know, people whose heritage is African, but they are not in Africa, whose heritage is Indian, but they're not in India. And where are you? Are you in the Caribbean? Is your heritage a new type of Caribbean identity? But of course, those identities were part of a British colonial system, and their countries had only got independence in the last 50 years and sometimes less. So I think there's a lot of complexity there, and these are difficult subjects to talk about, perhaps particularly for a person of white privilege such as myself.
But you sketched that really well, Arthur. And in fact, you've portrayed a picture, which is that this is one of the first spaces to globalize. I read a book in graduate school with a very provocative title, Sugar. And it points out that sugar was a strategic commodity in the late 17th and 18th centuries, the way that oil was in the 20th and silicon and lithography material is in the 21st. So this leads us to another question. If these were such wealthy and commodity exporting and geostrategically important societies then, why do they have an unsustainable debt crisis now? Why did sugar and the wealth of those locations disappear? And we're looking at places with failed economies.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, we have to talk about the transatlantic slave trade. The sugar economy had at its root a working population that were there not by any choice and you know, had been trafficked from Africa. And then later, even after slavery had ended in some of these territories, of course, people were working in conditions of indentured servitude, so almost slavery-type conditions. And of course, others were working in conditions of grinding poverty.
And so much so that even Toussaint Louverture,
yeah,
the Haitian leader who threw off French rule, although he may not have called it slavery, he kept those slave populations to push their nose to the grindstone to produce sugar.
Right. And so you have a setting where at a certain point of time, these islands were able to generate great wealth, but on the backs of enslaved peoples. Later on, the economic status of these islands shifts somewhat. In some cases, of course, they become supplanted. So if we look at the huge sugar-producing regions of the world now, in a fully globalized industrial society, we're talking about Brazil, we're talking about India, we're talking about other parts of the Americas, the relatively small land masses of the West Indies can no longer compete in that sense. But I think another element of this is actually the challenges of small states. And so if we take a country whose entire population is smaller than a relatively small town, so we're talking 100,000 people, it's not even a town like Guildford or Brighton or Reading, you know, we're talking
Tunbridge Wells style.
Right, exactly. We're talking fairly small towns that are not conceived of as sort of major entities in their own right. Imagine in that one place having to create an entire country. You have to have a judiciary, you have to have a police force, you have to have an education system, you have to have a health service. It's an enormous thing, and the inefficiencies of scale are incredibly challenging. So that's one element. Another element is that all countries in the modern era have to rely on financing. A country such as Britain, with a very large economy, you know, globally sixth largest economy, with hundreds of years of good credit behind it, you only need one stupid, badly conceived mini budget proposal.
Whatsoever are you talking about? are you trying to quartang this podcast?
I am trying to quartang this podcast. But that's a classic case of, if a country with all the status and resources and credit worthiness of Britain can very quickly find itself on the skids in the credit markets, imagine what it's like for a country whose entire economy is smaller than a medium-sized town in the south of England. And so then inevitably, these countries, when they do have to borrow to finance, they're borrowing at incredibly high interest rates, sort of almost like credit card debt. So they always face a level of challenge, both with the inefficiencies of scale and the inefficiencies of finance, that makes it harder for them to do the things that all countries have to do, like build roads, finance pensions, and so on.
I think you've sketched out very well some of the challenges of being a small state in today's globalized world. In the Caribbean, there is some kind of crisis of debt. Mm. Tell us about how that came about and how the debt crisis has actually led to what you might call state capture.
Yeah. In the Caribbean, you have countries that are very classically middle-income countries. And in sort of old money, in terminology that is probably now considered a bit outdated, so I apologize before I use it, second world. So
I'm going to disagree and say that second world is a term not just out of date, but it really referred to Soviet economies like, for example, Hungary and East Germany and the Warsaw Pact.
Yeah, but I suppose what we're talking about at a level of national income. So what you do not have, with one or two exceptions, but perhaps in parts of Haiti, Haiti's an outlier, as I've mentioned, you do not have people living in a sort of subsistence agrarian manner, as millions still live in India and lots of the African continent.
Right.
And you have quite a lot of people enjoying a quality of life that would be familiar to people, for example, in North America. So the wealthy communities of the Caribbean live in nice detached housing with air conditioning and gated compounds that would look not out of place in Miami or in outskirts of Houston or somewhere like that. But what you also have is very unequal societies. So you have a society where the GDP per capita may look analogous to a Central European country that is only a few years of development away from actually catching up with, say, the UK, whose own economic growth has not been particularly impressive in recent years. But GDP per capita in a small state, of course, can be very misleading, because by definition, a very tiny number of ultra wealthy people, of literally billionaires, can skew the numbers. So you have these states that are on paper not eligible for some of the kinds of aid money and development finance that would be eligible if you were, say, talking about countries in East Africa or South Asia. And I saw this directly as a High Commissioner as, you know, leading Britain's diplomatic engagement, there are people in Trinidad who live in a kind of grinding urban poverty, which might look familiar to people who've seen things about the slums of Rio de Janeiro or, you know, some of the mega cities of Asia. But on paper, Trinidad and Tobago is considered a wealthy country that is not eligible for any kind of development finance or development aid from the UK. And so you then have this weird situation where Trinidad feels like it's being punished for having had a measure of economic success, whereas, of course, there are plenty of people who, you know, in the Trinidad situation, who, as I say, are living in a very kind of precarious way. And so the governments in those regions have ended up having much less access to development aid and have ended up having to borrow a lot more to finance their own development. And this has created this debt crisis. And when you add to that, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that most of them will be paying much higher interest on their debt, this has become a kind of doom loop. So they end up with small economies, low credit worthiness, and a high debt to GDP ratio.
Yeah, and then because of the global enduring disorder, there are many get-rich-quick schemes that if you have the ability to use your sovereignty, you can, you know, sell offshore gaming licenses,
yeah,
or you can sell passports. Tell us more about how that kind of small offshore economy opportunity has played out.
One of the best case studies of this is Antigua and Barbuda. So that's a very small country. It consists of two main islands, and the entire population of both is, I think it's 150,000. A Texan called Alan Stanford set himself up in Antigua and started a offshore bank, which effectively, and the guy's now in prison, so he can't complain if I say this, it was effectively a money laundering operation. But this bank, the Stanford Bank, grew and grew to such a degree that it really became a systemic element of the entire economy of Antigua and Barbuda. And Stanford became the most sort of colorful character. In spite of his American background, he became very interested in cricket. He was financing cricket tournaments. He was the sort of the big kid in town. And then the financial crisis, the 2008 financial crisis happened. Unsurprisingly, his bank collapsed. But when his bank collapsed, it took with it the entire economy of Antigua, because he had become the economy, one single bank, in a way that even Britain, with its over-dependence on finance, would never have got anywhere close to this. So the country whose economy contracted by the greatest proportion during the financial crisis was Antigua. Now, on one level, we could say, well, it doesn't matter. It's just, you know, it's a tiny island. You know, it's sad for those people, but it doesn't matter in world terms. Certainly, it doesn't have a systemic impact on the world. But the degree to which you can then own a country, owning a country gives you certain things. You have a vote at the United Nations. You can have sovereign status. So you can sell passports, you can sell nationality, but you might get into the business of selling diplomatic passports. Now, that's an incredibly valuable and high-end product. If you look at some of these microstates in the Caribbean region, the selling of regular passports, there's definite evidence that that has been used by people who are involved with international organized crime, and I'm sure also used by very regular people who just for some reason wish to avail themselves of a new nationality. But there are small case studies, but definitely important ones, of people getting diplomatic passports. And of course, that avails them of a certain level of immunity around the world, which is extraordinarily
incredible. And it's shocking that you can purchase it.
Yeah.
But in our global enduring disorder, where there are no international rules about what constitutes a diplomatic passport, it doesn't surprise me that you can.
Yeah.
Maybe you could tell us a little bit more about money laundering, offshore gaming licenses, drug trafficking.
So in some cases, there's evidence that the entire states themselves have become effectively a shell for some kind of organized crime interest. And offshore gaming, so the gambling business, is a particularly fruitful one for organized crime groups. And if you just think about it, money laundering is the process of taking money whose provenance is unclear and probably dirty and laundering it that it can then be deposited in banks and spent in a normal way. And there is few better ways to do that than by running casinos. Someone shows up at a casino with $50,000 in cash. They convert it to chips. They may not play a single table, but at the end of the night, that is a deposit in a bank. So the operation of casinos, which you'll see across the Caribbean region, is one of the really valuable ones. But at a higher level of criminality is money laundering and the interaction with illegal trafficking, and particularly of narcotics. So if we think about that geography I talked about, at its closest point, Trinidad and Tobago is just over 10 miles from the South American landmass. So when you stand there in Port of Spain, you see a line of hills in the distance and you're looking at Venezuela. And so that is the visual representation of how easy it is for trafficking across that small strait of water. Now, some of that trafficking is human trafficking. Venezuela's gone through a multi-year crisis. People are trying to leave for reasons that are very understandable. Of course, there's the trafficking of weapons, but very importantly, there's the trafficking of narcotics, particularly cocaine, which ultimately is produced in those Andean countries, notably Colombia, but also Peru and Bolivia.
Might this be the only time in human history where a former prime minister has been personally arrested with cocaine on him?
Well, yes. So if we talk about the Andrew Foy, who was the prime minister of the BVI, the British Virgin Islands, which, of course, is still a British territory. So it has some independence in, for example, it can do its banking and its company.
Like a crown colony, like the Isle of Man.
Exactly, right. It elects its own domestic political administration. The head of the government there was caught up in a cocaine trafficking sting, which effectively was an FBI operation. And he was demanding, I think it was in the millions of dollars, from what he believed to be a South American cartel in return for routing major drug shipments through the BVI. And of course, we ask ourselves, well, what the hell was he doing? You know, I mean, however bad things might be, when you're the prime minister of a state, you probably don't need to get into that. Well, one answer is, well, the BVI traditionally has been a place where you go to hide dirty money. And there's a lot of pressure coming down on that business. And we talk a lot about tax havens and tax avoidance. And I don't think the British government's doing enough, but they're doing a bit. They're trying to create a transparent register of interests and all these sorts of things. And what that means is that effectively the elites of these micro states or micro territories are looking for other ways to make money. If they can't make it from money laundering, maybe they'll make it from drugs trafficking. So we now have this guy, Andrew Foy, as I mentioned, he's in jail in the US on very serious drugs charges. And he, you know, an elected premier.
And he allows the BVI to be a punchline to another joke, because before the BVI was the punchline to this joke that I love and I tell in my book. What do you get a billionaire Libyan oligarch's son for his third birthday? Do you know the answer, Arthur?
Well, it must be a BVI shell company.
Three BVI shell companies.
Oh, three. Yeah, very nice. Yes, his third birthday. Yes.
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yes. And that is, by the way, in the Miss Manners Guide to Rigorously Correct Kleptocracy.
Beautiful.
So, speaking of former premiers, tell us a little bit about the premier of Turks and Caicos.
Yes. So that's another case study. So this is another British territory. The BVI, Turks and Caicos, these are places that are basically too small to go it alone as sovereign states. The smallest sovereign state in the Caribbean is St. Kitts, which has a population of around 50,000. And BVI, Turks and Caicos, I think you're down into the 20,000s roughly. Michael Misik, who was the premier of Turks and Caicos, he was involved in systematic corruption, mostly to do with selling land on the territory. Turks and Caicos, a tiny place, has become very popular with a certain sort of ultra-rich. Although it's a tiny place, it's apparently the runway at the airport there is always sort of thick with private jets, people coming in, people who have this amazing sort of beachfront property and that sort of thing. And so in that case, these British overseas territories, and this actually exposes, I think, one of the dishonesties in the way that Britain administers these places. We basically say, yes, they're British territories, but they're basically autonomous. They run their own affairs. We can't interrupt them. We can't interfere. You know, they must do their own thing. Well, at the point when the premier of the Turks and Caicos had been shown to be corrupt into the tens of millions, we suspended the government. We basically reminded them that it is a colony. The British came in. They behaved like it's the 19th century. People sent from Whitehall came to run all the departments. Everyone was fired, and they sort of started again. And so this is a reminder that we could overnight suspend these governments and say, you're not going to do money laundering. You know, you're going to have a different type of economy, and maybe we'll finance you to do that.
Arthur, if this whole podcast thing doesn't work out because I'm on my way to becoming British, do you think they could suspend the government of one of these beautiful islands and I could get shipped out and, like, run the country?
I mean, you know, jobs come up in these places. They have to staff them, so who knows? So,
I don't
rule yourself out.
I don't know if I can order the disorder of, you know, global affairs, but of a few isolated Caribbean islands, I might be able to create some order there.
Well.
And speaking of trying to order the disorder in these different islands, you've had to deal with, you know, a very complicated situation in Trinidad and Tobago.
Yeah. So the first thing to know about Trinidad and Tobago is that it is one of the larger countries in the region, population of 1.25 million, which obviously is small by global standards, but that's a substantial number of people.
Larger than Iceland. I mean, it's a real size country.
Yeah, and larger than many states in the US. It's also a large economy because, unlike most of the economies in the region, it's not dependent on tourism, finance.
Oil and gas.
It's oil and gas. And of course, oil and gas is a major global commodity. At one point, Trinidad was one of the biggest suppliers of natural gas to this country, the transatlantic sort of gas market. So Trinidad, there's a lot of money sloshing around, and that inevitably means that there's a lot of corruption. And in the time I was there, just to illustrate this, the man who became notorious as vice president of FIFA, the governing body of world football, Jack Warner,
yes, of course,
was at the same time as being seen as one of the most notoriously corrupt figures in world football, was the Minister of National Security of Trinidad and Tobago. And that's a ministry which brings together both sort of Home Secretary and Defense Secretary in the British system. So an immensely powerful role. And this is a good example of how in small states, people can capture a huge amount of power to themselves. But more recently in Trinidad, there's been a lot of controversy around the Elections Commission. So most Caribbean islands have a history of very well-run and independently run elections under a sort of parliamentary system, many of them analogous to the British parliamentary system, adapted, of course, for their own scale and culture and so on. But there's been concerns in the Trinidad situation that this electoral commission has become very politicized. And indeed, there was a suggestion that, for example, there was accusations of gerrymandering, of boundary shifts, that the chair of the election commission in Trinidad had been appointed as a sort of political favor, and the, you know, the boundaries being adjusted to make it easier for the ruling party to win the elections there. But in a way, I would caution. What I find interesting about having lived in Trinidad and then returning to Britain is how many features of what I mistakenly thought of as small state problems are replicated in Britain.
This is the essence of what the disorder program is about, Arthur. I went to Libya and I was like, oh my God, you know, there are semi-sovereign institutions that rack up billions in liabilities and then they don't pay them, but then it's their connection to this bank and whatever, whatever. And then when I was in D.C. in the Trump period, I realized, oh, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
That is the insight that so many of us in our line of work have had, which is that these features, whether it's about corruption or liabilities or the interplay between an individual acting in his private capacity or using his official role to benefit him privately, yes, we may have seen them first in Libya or Iraq, but then we see them back home.
Yeah. And so if I was going to give the example that to me felt so sort of visceral as I saw it. As I mentioned, I lived in Trinidad 4 years. You know, my job was to be very on the ball about what was happening politically. And certainly it was a kind of place where if the government was commissioning services or commissioning some kind of procurement, there would be a certain type of person who would always be on the list, would always get the contract. And then, you know, fast forward to the COVID crisis in this country, and we learned that there was something called a VIP channel. There was a way in which people who had pre-existing relationships with the ruling party would be at the top of the list. That we learned that they were delivering products that turned out to be basically useless, but themselves becoming fabulously wealthy as a result. That to me felt like the sort of story that I became very used to seeing in Trinidad. And I admit, and I don't with any pride admit this, that I thought perhaps in a patronizing way, well, this is Trinidad. It's a small state. It's a younger country. It's finding its feet in terms of public administration. Well, au contraire, you know, in Britain, we have gone down that road as well. So what, as you say, it shows us is, I think, that this disorder is a creeping phenomenon. It can happen anywhere, and it can happen in countries that have a sense of self-regard as being uncorrupt, well-established, solid democracies.
After the break, we're going to hear about Haiti. So, Arthur, the picture that you've painted so far is of a fairly disordered space where foreign flows of capital, but also expertise and humans, sometimes human trafficking, can come in and out. Mm-hmm. This could allow economic production, but it can also allow criminality. How does that spill over into massive political upheaval?
So I guess the case study that's most relevant and is particular to right now is the situation in Haiti, where effectively we're looking at a situation of state collapse in the context of criminal gangs having taken over the major cities and effectively having much more power than the police and the forces of law and order. But to understand that, we have to go back a bit. So in 2021, the president of Haiti was assassinated by a group of Colombian mercenaries who subsequent investigations discovered had been financed via a sort of shell company in Florida. A very complicated story. It appears that they were sort of commissioned by groups that were around the prime minister at the time of Haiti, who was effectively the political beneficiary of the killing. Now, all this sounds like an intriguing plot for a sort of thriller novel, but this was a real thing that happened, that a private commercial interest group was able to assassinate the leader of a country.
That such a thing is possible illustrates many of the themes of the global enduring disorder, which is that because of the absence of international institutions, I might want to get rid of my political opponent, and rather than winning an election or even offing him in the streets, I can use money to hire a private military contractor or have an alliance with a transnational criminal group to then take control.
Yeah. And of course, it illustrates other concurrent elements, such as the fact that traditionally, the Caribbean was very much the United States' backyard. You've had, at different times, there's been U.S. troops on the ground in Haiti and in, you know, in other parts of the region, Grenada, Panama, and so on. But in more recent years, you know, the U.S. has turned inward slightly. The U.S., of course, has been very preoccupied with events in Afghanistan, in the Middle East, in Eastern Europe and so on. So this region on its backyard, a short boat ride from Florida, has been overlooked somewhat, and that has allowed things to spin out of control. You reach a stage where the state is no longer in control in Haiti. But even in countries that have a much stronger central state, so let's take Trinidad and Tobago as an example, you still have other threats where the criminality leaches into a level that is threatening to the entire state. And I'm talking, as surprising as it might sound, about sort of Islamism.
Are you?
Yeah. So as extraordinary as it might sound, Trinidad and Tobago was a significant contributor of recruits to ISIS. And I'm talking about ISIS in Syria. So there were people born in Trinidad and Tobago, people of Caribbean heritage, who were fighting in the war in, you know, the terrorist movement in ISIS in Syria. One of them, in fact, became a bit of a sort of poster boy for ISIS. He was featured, a long interview with him, featured in one of the sort of ISIS propaganda magazines because he was seen as this sort of great military guy. And it's believed that over 100 Trinidadians traveled to Syria. So it's quite extraordinary to think that people that grew up in what we imagine to be this sort of paradise island, most of them probably born into the Christian faith, converted to Islam, made this very difficult and dangerous journey to a country that they would, by definition, have no real connection to, and joined ISIS to fight there.
Wow. I was surprised to learn that the Mexican and Albanian mafias also operate in the Caribbean. And we're going to put a link in the show notes to a really interesting article that talks about the Pax Mafioso in Latin America and the Caribbean. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so what you've got there is areas where effectively the economic interest can very easily be kind of subsumed into maybe a single industry or a single economic activity. And it's very easy for example, a drugs cartel to almost take over the center of power. There are certainly cases where an entire police force is effectively under the thumb of a particular cartel.
And what I want to pull away from here is that when you have multiple different sovereignties, the difficulty of coordinating them makes things like enforcement so much harder.
And absolutely.
That traditionally, the reason why something like the EU or the United States worked really well is one set of law, one set of institutions. And what we're about here on Disorder is the coordination complexities. When you make coordination complexities between, oh, in Trinidad, they have this law, but then this is subsidized in Turks and Caicos.
Yeah.
And the BVI has this and the Cayman Islands that. It's nearly impossible to have uniform governance.
Totally.
This gets to the what is it all about? When there's disorder, do we need hegemonic order on the global level? Do we need strong states? Do we need centralization?
Yeah.
I want to frame this question, and in a way frame this whole episode, via a super fan question.
Great.
And thank you, Dr. Dawn Renfro, for writing to us again. We ran one of her questions on our Christmas episode, and I would say Dawn is now super fan number one. And if you're a super fan of this program, please write us to compete. We'll have a sweepstakes. So now I'm going to read Dawn's email. Dear Jason, I've been listening to the news recently about the distressing situation in Haiti. And in effect, you could say that the U.S. has for decades been a disorderer in Central America because of its opposition to democratic socialism. I hadn't been fully aware of the history, so I went to Wikipedia. What I concluded was that although the democratically elected socialists had their own flaws and issues with human rights, they weren't necessarily more flawed than their free market opponents, and perhaps they were less so. I ended up feeling very depressed about the legacy of the U.S. in Central America. You could argue perhaps that this is the reason why the U.S. currently has an immigration crisis on its southern border. My question to you, Jason, is there a counter-narrative? Is there a way of seeing U.S. foreign policy in Central America in a more balanced way, if not in a positive way? I'm aware that France and Canada have been, along with the U.S., part of the story of Haiti in the last couple of decades, at least. I find myself wondering why they are laying themselves open to accusations of imperialism in 2024, in the same way that the Western allies were accused of imperialism in their interventions in Afghanistan and Iraq. Is there any justification for foreign interventionist policies? And how can it be done without accusations of imperialism? Ukraine is probably a good example of an intervention which resists this accusation well. Oh my, Dawn, if we could solve your brilliant questions, we could actually create global order.
We'd have no podcast.
So, Arthur, I would, of course, like more Anglo-American leadership, but I am well aware that American, quote-unquote, interventions have fucked up the Caribbean. They've obviously fucked up Iraq and Afghanistan. And having a light touch of enforcing rules and regulations without meddling in someone's politics to, you know, a foreign power's advantage is a very delicate line.
Yes. I mean, I think that there's a lot there in that question. Central America during the Cold War, which obviously these are countries that are on the Caribbean Sea, so they're relevant to this discussion, but I'm talking about not the islands, but the land-based countries, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. You've got to be a very forceful proponent of America's Cold War policy to sort of defend it, I think. I read that. That's me.
Yeah, it's like Vietnam. You need to be pretty hardcore ideological to defend American policy there. I mean, the issue with the Sandinistas is obviously well known, and the Iran-Contra and the hypocrisy of American leadership.
And I think the one case study, setting aside Cuba, which we haven't talked about because I think Cuba is a separate
story. Sui generis.
Yeah. But if the one country of the island nations which was affected in this way is Grenada. Now, we can have a discussion about what was happening on Grenada in 83 when the American intervention happened. But the thing you really have to ask yourself, you know, Grenada is minuscule. The idea that somehow Grenada becoming a communist state would result in the sort of global victory of communism is frankly...
Well, that's just as absurd as the domino theory itself about Vietnam.
Exactly. So we can put all that on one side, but I think there are things, there's some specific policies which both the US and the UK have indulged in, which are literally exporting disorder. So both countries, and I think America does it at a bigger scale, export criminals to these regions. So people who are convicted of crimes in Britain, in the US, are exported back, because we call it deported, back to those regions. So what is the impact of sending hardened criminals to countries that are facing their own crisis with law and order, with organized crime, with gang violence? It's not hard to think about that question.
However,
yes,
if someone comes to the United States or the UK and they don't have the right to enter, you can't really say that the deporting of them is a deliberate attempt to export disorder. That was a bit much.
But what I would say is that in this case, what we're talking about, people who are here legally but are foreign citizens. So you be a foreign citizen here legally, you commit a crime, and this is a big phenomenon, particularly with Jamaicans being sent from Britain back to Jamaica. So much so that at one point, Britain was proposing to build a special jail in Jamaica for all the Jamaicans it wanted to send back to Jamaica. Jamaicans who, I say, were in Britain legally, but who were being deported back there. So that, to me, is quite problematic because, of course, the crimes that they committed were committed in Britain. There may well be the case that the environment into which these people were drawn into criminality was also a British one. But I think we need to talk about this issue of intervention because, Iraq and Afghanistan, you know, we hardly need to say anything about that as case studies of intervention failure. But maybe Haiti is a case study of not enough intervention. You know, Haiti is a very small state. It's very close to America. Its problems become American problems very quickly, literally as immigration problems, as problems of gang violence and criminality within America and in countries that are also adjacent to America. And unlike Afghanistan and Iraq, it's a country where America has the resources and the knowledge to be able to make an intervention that would probably have a dramatic impact and could potentially be lasting. Now, there are questions of imperialism, but the Haitian people are desperate for some kind of intervention because their country is in a state of collapse. Now, one of the ways, of course, that this can be sensitively managed is by involving other Caribbean countries. Several of these countries, notably Jamaica and to some extent Trinidad and Tobago, Guyana, have very small but fairly professional militaries that could be brought to bear to play a role, to sort of Caribbeanize such an intervention so it is not purely a kind of North American colonial expedition.
And by the way, I think that model is very appropriate elsewhere in the world.
Yeah.
I want a pan-Arab condominium of Gaza at the end of the war. I don't want an Israeli occupation.
No.
And the only way to make something that will be an internationalization work is to have partner countries from the same culture and religion of the place. And that's a model that I like. Arthur, let's order the disorder. So we may not have solved all of the world's problems in hearing about very interesting quirks in the Caribbean, you know, things that people don't know about in terms of ISIS recruitment. And then we had Dawn's super interesting question. How do we order the disorder in a place like the Caribbean? Can the West and the international community play a positive role? Can you propose some things, given the crisis that we have now, that can be implemented, you know, shovel-ready projects?
One thing would be a sort of financing system that would enable Caribbean countries to invest in clean energy infrastructure. Because we haven't talked about climate change. Climate change is very significant, but it's particularly significant. A lot of these small states rely on the least efficient method of power generation, which is basically burning diesel because, again, of these challenges of scale. But these are sunny, windy islands.
Absurd.
It's just
such
absurd.
A tragedy. I mean, it's like in Libya where they burn the most toxic crude when they have such great sun. It's probably the best country in the world for solar panels.
Yeah. And of course, it is particularly significant for these countries that you know, one of their great offers to the international community is this sense of these beautiful beaches, this wonderful natural environment. It's the last place on earth that you want to be burning diesel to keep the lights on. So making it easy for these countries to achieve net zero, it won't have a great significance in the global carbon dioxide.
But it's a great test case.
Yes.
But how do we do that? Give us something concrete.
Well, so concretely, it's literally about making the financing. Because they're paying so much, that in most countries, the renewable energies are more expensive than the old hydrocarbon energies. In those countries, it will immediately be cheaper because their hydrocarbon energies are so expensive. So it will pay for itself. They just need the credit. They need a credit backing facility, whether it's the World Bank or America's Aid Finance Solutions. And of course, the scale is
USAID. Great.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Wow. So, you know, you get that financing in there and you're going to see results, and the investors will make money and there'll be less pollution and people will be happier.
Yeah. And then it also makes it easier for those countries to spend money on things that will actually make their societies better, like better education, better law enforcement, and so on.
Great. So, with the crisis going on in Haiti, what does this tell us in terms of ordering the disorder globally? I feel like we see things get out of control and then they act, when a stitch in time could save nine. So
yes.
If Haiti is the thing that we could have prevented, what lessons does this tell us for the Caribbean in general?
Well, let me give some examples that are relevant there. So historically, the British Royal Navy, until not that long ago, would have a regular military patrol. It was often known as the West India Guard ships. It doesn't really matter what it was called, but they would have a full military patrol which existed to do various things. One was to deter this maritime trafficking of guns, of drugs, or so on. It's also to give a sense of security, which, you know, sometimes the sense of security is extremely significant. And thirdly, it's to have a sort of resource on the ground. So if there's a crisis, you're not then spending the next 3 months talking about how do we respond. You can respond immediately. Now, we stopped doing that because we had commitments in the Middle East. We're scaling down our military. We're trying to pretend that the Caribbean doesn't matter to us anymore. Sort of, let's forget the difficult period of the empire, so on and so forth. So I think it's a great example of something where you can't just say, well, you know, the president's got a lot on his mind at the moment. Well, of course he has. He's the president of the United States or the prime minister. You have to have governments that can do more than one thing at once.
And of course, we need to be able to walk and chew bubblegum. What about the question of small states? They're not having economies of scale. Maybe they do need development aid, but the development aid doesn't go to them because they have a few billionaires who buy vacation houses there and pull up the
data.
The data. How should we address this?
Well, I think one of the things there is actually about helping the Caribbean region achieve effectively a single market. So there has been a long-running debate in the Caribbean about an analogous market. And of course, it is very necessary in a region of very small states, the inefficiencies of scale, some of the things that have sadly become a feature of our lives post-Brexit, that certain things are not available in the shops, or the cost of ordering something from one country to another, will be familiar to anyone who's lived in the Caribbean. Making it easier for the countries of the Caribbean to achieve a single market. And of course, that needs a lot of external support. There's a lot of complexity there. There's a lot of regulatory support. That would actually help their countries to grow economically very quickly.
So to end with one final attempt to order the disorder, the most controversial, are the Caribbean nations owed some kind of compensation for slavery? You have famously written, Arthur, how Britain broke the world. War, greed, and blunders from Kosovo to Afghanistan, 1997 to 2022. Obviously, Britain's breaking the world in this question of compensation for slavery is a couple of centuries before that. But I think that you are in as good a position as anyone to talk about this very, very challenging topic, morally and structurally and economically, of British liability to others for damage to them personally and their descendants, as well as the international system. So what would you say?
Yeah.
Compensation for slavery?
Well, I'm not going to say yes or no because it's a really complicated question. But let me just describe my own journey on this, because when I first went to Trinidad and I first started hearing about this, I didn't at any stage think I should be defending the history of slavery. But
But you also had every right to say, I'm a British diplomat now.
Yeah.
I don't carry some, you know, white guilt complex for something that somebody's great, 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 great grandfather did, and you personally did not do.
Right. So that is the basic idea. You say, well, this is now, you know, we're talking about 200 years ago, and of course, some of it will be longer than 200 years, and it's hideous and it's outrageous, and I'm happy that society now understands in a universal way, rather than in just a pocketed way, that we reject this entirely. But who are we compensating? We can't compensate those people. My own views have evolved because it is very clear that there are institutions, entities, and even individuals in Britain who remain beneficiaries. You know, there are some individuals who are literally living in grand houses whose ancestors made their money from the slave trade and whose ancestors are then compensated, specifically given huge sums of cash.
And for listeners who are interested, the Empire Pod did a really great series on this. And yes. I'm talking about William Dalrymple and Anita yes. Anand's amazing podcast yes. where you can see how institutionally, for example, the Duke of this and yes. this of that
exactly.
really benefited from a quasi-monopolistic control over human slave labor.
Yes. And a lot of the credit for this work goes to scholars in the Caribbean region. There's, for example, Hilary Beckles is one, but there are many others who have done the hard graft of analyzing the beneficiaries who received compensation when slavery was ended in the 19th century, early 19th century, and traced that lineage. And many people in this country will, of course, have some of that ancestry. Now, I think it's where it gets complicated. If you are living in a grand country house with thousands of acres and, you know, you might know where that came from. If you enjoy a sort of prosperous middle-class life, is that in some way due to an ancestor who might have owned slaves or might not? You know, that
gets very tenuous.
It's very tenuous. But then that's why, you know, compensation for slavery, it's not about individuals. We don't go to someone, the Duke of whatever, and say, right, you need to sell your property and pay up. But we might need to understand that as a country, we have a duty to those countries. One of the things that modern genetic science tells us is that trauma can be inherited generationally.
Epigenetically.
Yeah. And again, you know, people were very dismissive of this. People would say, yes, I understand that your ancestors were enslaved, but you weren't enslaved. You're a free person, make your own choices. And I think often people use that to blame people in the Caribbean for some of the tragedies that have befallen them. I think we are now starting to understand more. So there is a question of whether or not Britain needs to recognize, of course, and there are other countries, you know, the Netherlands, France, Portugal, you know, so
the US.
Yeah. And of course, in the US, the complexity there is that it is within its own
land. But also debts to Africa and stuff. Yeah.
So I haven't answered the question because what I don't know is exactly how we finish this discussion. But I think what we're failing to do at the moment, Britain is failing to do, is willing to enter into the discussion. Now, CARICOM, the regional grouping of Caribbean states, wants to have this discussion. And I can understand British reluctance to enter into it. But I also think by refusing to enter the discussion, we're kind of sending the message that we don't believe it's a thing. And that's certainly for my own journey on this. I accept it is a discussion that needs to be had. And that doesn't mean that we know exactly where it will end. Obviously, if impoverished people in Britain have to pay even more tax in order that
doesn't work.
A wealthy person in the Caribbean
yeah.
benefits, you know, that isn't good. But equally, if people living in terrible conditions in city slums in the Caribbean, surrounded by incredibly high homicide rates and social collapse, receive some kind of long-term support from Britain, which I think this is what it's got to be, as a recognition of the impact of what our ancestors did to their people. I think that might be just.
Well, thank you for trying to order the disorder with me, Arthur. And of course, there was a lot to unpack there. So I hope you will join me in future episodes where we can delve into the question not only of compensation for slavery, but other of history's myriad wrongs and how they could lay the way for some kind of global order.
Well, it's been a great pleasure, Jason. Thank you for having me.
Well, that's it for this week. If you too want to help order the disorder, not only in the Caribbean, not only with slavery, you can tap follow right now and you will be notified when every episode launches. If you want to compete with Dawn Renfro to be a super fan, please join our Substack by the link in the show notes. And if you have a question that might just spark a whole episode, write us an email about it at disordershow@gmail.com. Finally, read more about this very complex and intriguing topic by following our links in the show notes, and you can find out about Caribbean drug lords. Our producer is, as always, the one, the only, George McDonough. Our executive producer is Neil Fearn. Thanks for listening, and I hope you have an orderly week.